All right, here we go with yet another, and this will be the final segment in that Civil War series that I entitled The War Between Estates. And this is the I-Man, you all know him. I just wanted to talk to him a little bit about it and close out with this discussion. Couldn't get him on earlier, so that's why it's more or less a postscript to the other 5 hours that are up there. And what I wanted to do, I-Man, was... And it's a leading question, I understand. But I'll set it up with this statement and tell me if it's accurate. We know that there was a certain degree of influence in the United States due to Britain's involvement in the national banks. Would that be a correct statement?
Yeah.
All right. Now, we know that Jackson didn't allow the renewal, I guess, of what would have been the third charter or the charter for the third bank.
Right.
Now, that could not have been looked at favorably. In fact, Jackson was had an attempt on his life, and if the story is true, it may have been Providence. He just might have been a lucky guy, because apparently the assassin's two guns both jammed. Is that your understanding of that episode?
the two guns that jammed?
Well, yeah, I mean, supposedly Jackson had an assassin who was going to hit him for, of course, messing with the money.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently the assassins, both pistols jammed, and they arrested the guy and they threw him in prison. So that was kind of interesting. That should have happened that way, because he escaped, obviously, the fate that awaited what's, I guess, widely believed to be what happens to a president if you mess with the money.
Right.
Ergo, I would assume that there was something about that with Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, and Kennedy, although there was a whole heap of other things, too.
Yeah, mainly it was with the money, but it's also that they said that they were going to go with the Constitution and the powers to be that control this country don't want anything to do with the Constitution or any republic, and that's why they had to destroy it. Even though they created it, they're the ones that destroyed it.
Well, yeah, and we'll have more about that later on. That's going to be kind of a little teaser for... something new coming from the I-Man.
Uh-huh.
But it seemed to be quiet, at least on the surface, between the time Jackson did that in the 30s until, I guess, the latter half of the 1850s and then eventually the 1860 when the Civil War was finally instigated.
Yeah, well, actually, it was because of the wildcat banking strikes and everything from 1935 on up until... when the real first bank was installed in 1840 by the well, it was the Whigs destroyed it, and they were in power for about 4 or 5 years till 1846, and then it was reinstalled. And
what was destroyed? What was it?
The first real bank that the United States and the states had, where they dealt in specie only, and it wasn't any paper money or anything like that.
All right. Was it a sort of, for lack of better words, okay, a federal banking system?
No. It was called the Independent Sub-Treasury. That was the actual legal name of the bank.
All right, and that was brought in more or less to stop some of the craziness that had been going on in the banking system.
Yeah, because all the bankers were stealing the states and the United States blind, and that's why they bought in the first bank, because all the states and the United States were putting their money into these private quote, federal banks, and they were absconding with a lot of their money and everything like that. The states didn't like it, and that's why Jackson refused to charter the first bank, the third bank.
Right, all right. So we have two things going on. We had the death to the national banks, versions 1 and 2,
right,
that started back with Hamilton.
Right.
But then finally there was a period, obviously, of some kind of instability. And then
uh-huh.
we see what's been called, and what was that terminology again?
The Independent Sub-Treasury.
Okay. Now, that was some kind of centralized structure, was it not?
Oh, yeah. That's where all the states and all the United States put all their money, the
okay.
real gold and silver, into it. and they dealt strictly in specie. That's all, gold and silver. They didn't have any paper money or anything like that.
All right. Now, I would assume, in particular...
But now, the people, okay, this was just for the states in the United States. It wasn't for the people. But then it became so popular that the people used it.
All right. So this really what you wouldn't call on face in the beginning a commercial bank?
No.
Where people can walk in on the street, off the street like we do now?
No. That's not how it started out.
Okay. But it wound up that way.
Oh, yes, it wound up that way because it was so good, and nobody was, the states weren't getting ripped off, and of course that affected the people in those particular states because they had to cough up anything that they might have on taxes, but there was no income tax then. It was taxes on trade and tariffs and imports and export duties and stuff like that, and that affected the people because of the price rise that was charged. Now, of course, if Joe Blow was dealing with farm implements or something like that, and it was being exported, that means from one part of the country to another, it didn't mean it was foreign exports and imports. But, if the states got ripped off and they had to buy some of this material for their, what they would do would raise and jack the price up on that to cover their loss. And, of course, that spiraled down to the people, the end user that used it and whatever they were, whatever tax they paid on it, an excise tax or whatever. That would rise up, and then, of course, that's why they went to this independent sub-treasury where there would be no fluctuation of inflation or anything like they had with the first and the second bank when they dealt in paper.
All right. Would you say, then, that the period of the independent sub-treasury was a relatively honest thing?
Yeah. That was the most honest part that this government ever had.
Which means
then, of course, it ran all the way up to 1913, and then they bought in the Federal Reserve, which was sitting in the background all along, and they were both running together. And then in 1921 is when they abolished the independent sub-treasury, and they slid everything over to the Federal Reserve, who was supposed to be the fiscal agent of the United States government in handling the money. And when they did... wiped the independent sub-treasury out, all the gold and silver was transferred to the Federal Reserve. And in New York, they had two separate vaults, one for all the money of the independent sub-treasury, and the other was from their own. And then they started mixing it and everything, and it was all compounded, and we ended up with all the money, the gold and the silver, that the real sub-treasury had was shipped overseas by the Federal Reserve in doing business deals, which they lost. And then by 1929, all that money was gone, and the American people who had all this gold and silver in the banks, because it was all gold and silver operating then, along with paper money, they couldn't get it, and that's what caused the crash of 29, is simply because the Federal Reserve took all of the gold and the silver, did business deals in Europe, and they fell through, and they couldn't pay the people the money when they wanted it. And that was the cause of the closing of the banks and the crash that was actually caused by the banks, just like happened today.
In these present times, right? Don't get people all freaked out, right?
Right.
It's bad enough. Well, here's where I'm going, though. In that period of what would be called stability and honesty, if you will, by nature of their natures, the bankers couldn't be happy with that. And also, at this time now, you see whatever monarchies that were involved, especially Great Britain in particular.
Right.
So what was their role in this period between the closing and the non-renewal of the national banks and this time we have of the independent sub-treasury. What, I mean, we don't hear too much about what was gone over there. Do you have any clue as to, and I'm sure they weren't happy about it, do you know anything about what was going on with them during that time?
Yeah, they weren't happy about it at all. And there's a couple things that, well, there's other people that come in involved in this, but the Lincoln, when I have a direct quote, what he quoted on some of his stuff, I'm trying to look at it here and see where it's at. That was in just after the war of, he's talking about the war of 1861 to 1865, the so-called Civil War.
Right.
And I have the direct quote. I can read that later. But
Well, here's
also from Samuel Morse, from the Morse Morse Code. I have stuff, you know, from him that Lincoln had talked about him also. But, yeah, the international bankers at that time was the Bank of England. Before that, it was the Tories and the Tuscans and you know, that's what the Vatican and the...
And then we had the Venetian banking families too, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, the Vatican's banking was the Knights Templar. That was originally way back when, but they fell out, and then the Vatican in England actually borrowed money from the Tuscans, from the Guillos, and there's a whole bunch of different people. But then they formed the Private Bank of England in I think 1864. Don't quote me
right
on that date, but I don't have it in front of me, but they did create the private bank in the city of London, and that became the like Washington D.C. or New York City, and it was the banking capital of England, and it was totally separate from England. It had nothing to do with England at all, except that it's sitting there in England.
Right.
You know. But like Lincoln, you know, he. The little history on him is he was a lawyer, but he started out surveying and he was a postmaster of New Salem from 1833 to 1836. And, you know, he studied law. He moved to Springfield. That's where everybody knows him from. But he was actually born in Hardin, Kentucky.
Right.
And they were... his mother and father was belonged and owned a Spencer company, and they settled in southern Illinois, and he was even that's when he went into office and running for he was a Whig, which was totally against the bank, and was supposed to stay with the Constitution, so-called, that forbid the United States from having dealing in anything but gold and silver, and they couldn't deal in paper, they couldn't have banks and all this. But what people don't realize is this was done in 1751 by the Currency Act, when the king and the banking system told the colonies at that time, which was the Virginia Company. And the Virginia Company was, that's all there was in this country. People think, they come in and they formed all these 13 colonies. No, that wasn't it. It was a Virginia Company, which was owned by the king and the bank and the Pope at the time. And the Virginia Company ran from the St. Lawrence Seaway all the way down to Georgia border and all the way to the west of the Mississippi River up through the Great Lakes. And that was Virginia Company. And that was the first charter of 1609 by the king. And and John Locke, he was supposed to be for freedom and everything that everybody reads about. Well, that man was just the opposite. He was not for freedom because he was the one that wrote the Currency Act of 1751 and was instrumental in putting it into this government here. Well, supposedly a government, but it's a corporation. That's all it is.
Right.
We never had a government. It's always been a corporation.
Well,
and that's what we have been dealing with. So all those particular states at the time was in the Virginia Company, and they broke off into like little satellite companies. That's the best way you can put it. And that's how they operated. And that's why Jackson, you know, you can extrapolate and go all the way back into history and bring it forward, and that would spend about 2 or 3 hours of radio time,
sure,
which we don't have. And but basically, that's what happened. And then Lincoln was a Whig, and that's why he, when he got into office and the Whigs got there, they abandoned the independent sub-treasury. They abolished it. And not until they lost the elections in 1865 did they, or not 1865, but when the Whigs lost, it was 1846. And then what happened is the next president came in and reinstalled the independent sub-treasury because it was so horrible when the Whigs got rid of it. You know,
right.
There's the bankers coming back in and sucking all the money again.
Well, let me hold you right there because I want to tie up two loose ends because people will be trying to follow. And we jumped it. But first of all, you talked about the origins of the settling of what is now known as the United States of America was under Virginia Corporation.
Yeah, Virginia Company.
A company, rather, right. And what happens
is... They
called
it the Virginia Company.
Well, this is where you get down to the fact that what this new country was a new market. It was an investment and a commercial enterprise that was underwritten by Great Britain.
Yeah.
And they gave, and I assume they gave out the land patents and such for people to develop what is now known as the colonies, correct?
Yeah, because Washington, believe it or not, he was a surveyor. And when he was 16, and what he did was he was just like any other corrupt politician, but he knew certain surveyed land was more valuable, and he kept that for himself, and then he sold it and made a killing on it to the other business people that were coming over from Europe over to here, and I mean, you know, that's where he made his money.
Right.
He was a millionaire. You know, he was like Bill Gates is today.
Well, this sets up the fact that, again, and rightly so, Great Britain had a financial investment in the New World.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and of course then when certain noises are being made about throwing off the crown,
mm-hmm.
which led to what we call the American Revolution, they can't be happy about it because, obviously, again, they want their money for what they staked years before. Now, the Currency Act, I just want to make this clear because people will think this is something you want. The way things have been set up by the Crown is that you can only deal in gold and silver. There could be no issuing of paper currency.
No, and no banks.
Okay, now,
have a bank.
People would say, but that's the way we want it. Why was that a bad thing back then?
Okay, here's what it was we had no gold and silver. It wasn't being mined over here at all. And all the colonies had to rely on France, Spain, and Great Britain for their gold and their money. They did all the trading and were paid in gold and silver. Okay? Now, what happened was that meant that anytime the gold and silver dried up, what did they get for their gold, for their pelts and their cotton and everything else that they traded over to Europe with?
Nothing.
They got nothing. And it fell through. And so what happened was when they did the Currency Act of 1751, the states of New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey ignored it and went to their paper money, and that's where the Massachusetts Bay Note came in, and that was the best paper money that this country ever had.
Because it was backed by commodities, right?
Yeah, it was backed by commodities. It was backed by wool and cotton.
Pigs.
And in fact, I have a blow-up of it here. And it's hard to read,
right?
Because it's so old and everything. And even though I did blow it up, it, like three times the size of what it is, it was, let's see, 10 pounds of sheep wool, so many parts of a pound of beef, tea, leather, sole leather. It was all the things that the people relied and lived on.
Necessities.
At right. the time.
Right.
So you could take and buy this note and trade it in 20 years later, and it would stay the same, and no matter what the price or of the commodity based what it was, you still got that. And it was... 1780, AD of 1780, the one I'm looking at here, and it was paid to the 230 pounds because they still dealt in pounds. That's $2.2 per pound in silver. And this was, this particular one was in our year, the Lord of 1784, and, oh, corn, they also had corn.
Right.
68 pounds of the, so many fourth, seventh parts of pound of beef and all this.
All right, so, but that system then was did two things. One, it dealt with necessities that were needed. That's what backed the
right.
the paper. And secondly, it cut the crown out because they didn't have to deal with their gold and silver and the surpluses and the deficits thereof.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And you got to remember, the person that's sitting in the background is the Vatican. It's the Pope. Because the Vatican owned the Virginia Company.
How did they do that?
Remember 1213 when the Pope told the king and all the subjects of Great Britain that they were excommunicated and their souls would go to hell when they died, and if they didn't want that, then the Pope would recommunicate the people and the king, but for that he wanted all the subjects and the king's property, and the king turned it over to him in 1215. Actually, 1213.
Who's on the throne then? Was that one, King John?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he did, and he relinquished all the land and all the British Empire to the Pope. So the Pope is really sitting there watching what's going on over here. And, of course, when the king, and they had the 1783 treaty, the Pope says, that's my property.
Well,
I'm losing everything if you turn it over and they become free.
Well, here we go, and I had sent you this. Charles Wilcox dug it up somewhere, and that was the text of a papal bull from Pope Leo XIII in 1891.
Right.
And it states throughout that, and especially at the end, as he called it, he said, the Romanist Church has the rights to everything. That's their mindset. That's what they believe.
Yeah, that's the tenet of the Catholic Church, is that no man anywhere in the world can own a possession. They have no rights of possession. The Church owns it.
And I want to tell you, you had mentioned of this, and you had said it happened in New York. Not a big deal. I just wanted to mention that. I actually took a look for the only time that a pope kissed the terra firma of the United States. That was John Paul II, October 1st, 1979, and it was on the tarmac of Logan Airport in Boston.
Right.
That's when he kissed the ground. Everybody thought that was because he had a bad flight and he was happy. You know, I'm kidding.
No.
But, I mean, the thing is, everybody thinks that's so neat. What it is he just went ahead and claimed it.
Yeah, it's his property, so he got down and he kissed it. Oh, my mother country.
Yeah, and they asked him, why don't you do it again? And they gave some kind of excuse for it in the papers, and you can read it still if you do a search. Especially I guess, in the Boston newspapers, but whatever. He said he never had to do it again, and it was a reason for it, but we know why he didn't have to do it again.
Right.
So one time will cover it all. Now, going back in time, and here's what I had asked some of the other guests. It may be a coincidence. You'll tell me if you have any knowledge about this, but at the time that Jackson kicked out the bank, we're in the 30s. It is reported that about that same time, or shortly thereafter, British-trained provocateurs known as the Knights of the Golden Circle became somewhat, I guess, involved in the southern states, reportedly beginning paramilitary organizations. They called them shooting clubs. And this was more or less getting them ready, though they may not have known it, the men of the South, for what would be a coming battle. Now, is that anything that you covered, or do you want to speak to it, please?
Well, that's a good point, because let me bring in Lincoln's direct quote. And this is, here's his quote. Now, I'm going to read it verbatim out of the book. This, American Civil War of 1861-1865, would never have been possible without the sinister influence of the Jesuits. We owe it to Popery that we now see our land reddened with the blood of her noblest sons. Though there were great differences of opinion between the South and the North on the question of slavery, neither Jeff Davis, he was the president of the Confederacy, nor any one of the leading men of the Confederacy would have dared to attack the North had they not relied on the promises of the Jesuits under the mask of democracy, the money and the arms of the Roman Catholic, even arms of France, were at their disposal if they would attack us. I pity the priests, the bishops, and the monks of Rome in the United States when the people realize that they are, in great part, responsible for the tears and the bloodshed of this war. I conceal what I know on that subject from the knowledge of the nation, for if the people knew the whole truth, this war would turn into a religious war, and it would at once take a tenfold more savage and bloody character. It would become merciless, as all religious wars are. Remember the Crusades?
Sure.
That's what it was, a religious war. Yeah. It would become a war of extermination on both sides. The Protestants of the North, both the North and South, would surely unite to exterminate the priests and the Jesuits. If they could hear what Professor Samuel Morse, that's the famous Morse code guy, mm-hmm. has said to me of the plots made in the very city of Rome, i.e. the Vatican, to destroy this republic, and if they could learn how the Roman Catholic priests, nuns, and monks, which daily land on our shores under the pretext of preaching their religion, instructing the people in their schools, taking care of the sick in the hospitals, are nothing but the emissaries of the Pope, of Napoleon, and other despots of Europe, to undermine our institutions, alienate the hearts of our people from our Constitution and our laws, destroy our schools, and prepare a reign of anarchy here as they have done in Ireland, in Mexico, and in Spain, wherever they are any people who want to be free.
All right.
And that's the end of the quote.
Now
what Samuel Morse said, and I got his direct quote, let us examine the operations of the Austrian Society, the St. Leopold Foundation, for it is hard to work all around us, yes, here in this country, with its headquarters in Vienna, that's Austria, under the immediate direction and inspection of the Austrian Prince Metternich.
Right.
It makes itself already felt through the American Republic. If emissaries are here, who are the emissaries? They are Jesuits, this Roman Catholic society of men that exert their tyranny for upwards of 200 years at length, became so formidable to the world, threatening the entire subdivision of all social order, that even Pope, i.e., that's Clement the 14th, whose devoted subjects the Jesuits are, must be, by their vow of society, was compelled to dissolve them in 1773. They had not been suppressed, however, for 50 years before the waning influence of popery and deposition required their useful labors to resist the light of democratic liberty and the Pope Pius VII, simultaneously with the formation of the Holy Alliance in Europe, revived the order of the Jesuits with all their power. Now, that was in 1814 when they did that. In exchange for his relief from prison, where he had spent 5 years under Jesuit persuasion, that was Pope Pius VII,
okay,
who was in jail, and then they released him. And do Americans need to be told what Jesuits are? If any are ignorant, let them inform themselves of their history without delay. No time is to be lost. Their workings are before you in every day's events. They are a secret society, a sort of Masonic order with super added features of revolting odiousness and 1,000 times more dangerous. They are not merely priests or priests of one religious creed. They are merchants and lawyers and editors and men of any profession having no outward badge in this country to the USA by which to be recognized. They are all about in your society. They can assume any character, that of angels of light or ministers of darkness, to accomplish their one great end, the service upon which they are sent, wherever that service may be. They are educated men, that's Jesuits, prepared and sworn to start at any moment and in any direction and for any service commanded by the general of the order, the superior general, the Black Pope, bound to no family, community, or country by the ordinary ties which bind men and sold for life for the cause of the Roman Pontiff. That's it. That's what Samuel Moore said to Lincoln.
Well,
and that's why in 1783, a lot of people read it. They don't know what they're reading because they don't know the foundation. And when the king said the Holy Trinity, a lot of people, even including me, before I found all this, who is the Holy Trinity? You're thinking, okay, well, there's Jay and our country was over there. That's one of them. And you got the king. That's the other one. Now, Trinity means three. Who's the third? And why are they Holy Trinity? It's the Pope, the King, and the bank. They're the Holy Trinity.
All right.
Had nothing to do with the people that was sent over there, Jay and all them, to sign the Treaty of Peace.
Well, it would seem that the United States was the last nation to really be in the crosshairs of the Vatican.
Well, yeah, because what the Vatican was is they had to destroy the Lord's Word. There's a white pope and the black pope, and when any republic was started, the Jesuits were right there to destroy it. They had to, and it's rather odd because. getting into the particular the new book that I have is the instigators, the ones that wrote the Constitution, told the Founding Fathers, look, we're going to run a blockade against you. You have no Navy. We own the Navy. Just like when we ran a blockade against Cuba. Hey, Cuba couldn't fight us, right? And the blockade worked. Well, they could run a blockade against here, and they said that they would take all of the possessions. Now, remember, the Pope says nobody has any possessions. He owns it. He owns England. He owns all the people. And these were all British subjects. All the Founding Fathers were British subjects. And the word founding in the Founding Fathers, if you look it up and you follow that etymology of the word founding, it goes back to religious church. They were founding fathers, which meant they were founding the religion of the Pope on this land called the United States, which was a subcorporation of the Virginia Company.
Right. Well, here's what I'm I'm thinking.
But that's why we never won the war of 1776.
No. It's almost like with the mafia. I mean, it's like, why shed blood? Let's get them through business.
That's right.
And let's get them through finances by the short hair. No sense.
Now, here's what Lincoln said, and I'm quoting this from the American History, Encyclopedia of the American History Reports, which was a school book, what you can't find today. This was printed in 1955, and I happened to find it in an old bookstore. And it says, in his first inaugural, Lincoln restated his constitutional doctrine that the contract between the states was binding and irrevocable. Wait a minute. Why did they say in the Declaration of Independence that any government that comes against the people and they don't like it, they have a right to throw it off, right?
Right.
Well, why did Lincoln say that it was a contract, which it was, between the states that was binding and irrevocable? It can't be thrown off? And when you read the North Carolina Constitution, it says that same thing in the Third and Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of North Carolina. The state cannot secede from the United States. But yet, in the paragraph before it, it says the same thing that the Declaration of Independence said in the third article of the North Carolina Constitution. That it can be thrown off.
Well,
yeah, and he said in here that he didn't hesitate to use his dictatorial powers. That's Lincoln, which with he was invested. Well, that's the War Powers Act. And then here's Lincoln's direct quote: "My paramount object is to save the Union, and not either to save or destroy slavery." August 22nd, 1862.
Yeah.
So the war was not over slavery at all, and he even said that.
Well, it was an emotional and quasi-religious cause.
Yes.
That was, I guess, more or less held up to the world to make it seem like it was something holy, if you will. And in essence, it wasn't. It was all about business again.
Right. And I'm going to blow a lot of people's minds. Here's a myth, the Rothschild International Banker myth. All right?
Okay.
They played a malign role in the Civil War. Now, a lot of people would say that they fronted the money. No. And here's why. The Rothschilds, the Jewish Rothschilds, was abhorring slavery and would not loan any country that promoted slavery, and they would not loan the money to the United States for the war. Many people don't know that.
All right, now now what are we looking at? Quote, what the United States was at that time? It was that they would withhold any money that might have been sent to the
any
Federalists.
Government. Yeah,
to the North.
Any government that.
The South rather.
Yeah, any government that allowed slavery.
All right, so we're looking at Lincoln that wasn't necessarily anti-slavery.
No.
Obviously, you had abolitionists that came out of the North, and perhaps their cause was true. But what I'm assuming the Rothschilds divined was that, look, the United States really isn't opposed to slavery, no matter what's going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, because the editor of the Harper's Weekly, here's his quote. "You do a great injustice to the eminent firm of Rothschilds here. The firm of M.M. Rothschild & Son are opposed to slavery and in favor of the Union. A converted Jew, Erlanger, was taken a rebel loan of £3 million and lives in this city, and Baron Rothschild informed me that all Germany condemned this act of lending money to a slave-holding government." That's our government. "And that so great was Republic opinion against it that Erlanger and Son dared not offer it on the Frankfurt Bourse. In short, the truth that it was a Catholic international banker, Erlanger, whose son was married to the daughter of Senator Seidel of Louisiana in the Catholic Church, who sought to further the activities of the Society of Jesus in undermining the Union." End quote.
Just do me a favor, repeat that one person's name. Was that Slidell or Seidel?
S-L-I-D-E-L-L.
All right.
Slidell of Louisiana.
Okay. I'm going to have to address this later on. I just want to interject just for a moment. I purchased a book which I had read a long time ago, which ironically was published by the St. Leo College Press when they had one, obviously.
Uh-huh.
They had to have one if they published this, but it no longer exists. That's the point. And the
right.
book I thought was excellent. I thought it was a very dispassionate look at what was going on in the Confederacy during the Civil War. It was called Divided We Fall, and it is a collection of essays on Confederate nation building. Slidell
uh-huh.
is mentioned in there, and that's why I had to have you repeat that name, because I don't remember in what particular capacity he was spoken about, and whether or not, you know, again, there were traitors on both sides.
Right.
And in that government. I mean, it was spy versus spy versus spy. And I just want to mention one thing, and I don't know if I have time to read it, and it's not a real big deal, but what was very interesting in this, there was a character by the name of James Bullock, who was a Confederate agent in Europe and brokered a deal with shipbuilders in and around Liverpool, and it may have been other places.
Mm-hmm.
To build warships.
Right.
However, there was this neutrality act that both Britain and France observed. But
right.
they got around that deal because as long as they didn't outfit it with supplies, guns, and soldiers, it was just another ship.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was they built them. Bullock and other members of the Confederate Navy would sail them back, and then they would come across with nothing but cotton and other goods, basically in repayment for what they got.
Right.
So here you have Great Britain, not necessarily the Bank of England, as you've just stated, mm-hmm. with Rothschilds at the head, but
right.
it was mercantilists, and it was shipbuilders who were making money
both
sides of the Civil War.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that senator's first name is John.
Okay. Oh boy. I might do a little postscript after this because that name popped up and it stuck in my brain.
Yep.
And that's scary to first think about at all.
Well, what it was the marriage to the daughter of Commodore Parry and the niece of Senator John Slidell.
Slidell, right.
Made him a kinsman by marriage of the apostate Erlanger.
Okay.
And lent false color to the rumors of his support of the rebels.
All right. I tell you what, it does factor into what I wanted to read. It's just two paragraphs. Would you allow me to just set this
sure.
up? Okay.
It's your show.
It's so nice that I ask rhetorically these polite questions. You know, it's like if you said no, I go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I'll make it quick. Let's see. All right, this is talking about Bullock. Finally, apart from the South's military needs, a trip home would afford Bullock the opportunity to confer with Secretary Mallory, who is the Secretary of the Navy. Should the ship enter Savannah safely, this is one of those warships that was built in England,
mm-hmm.
he planned to return to England with a cargo of cotton. A successful voyage would establish a precedent for the Confederate government. It would show that government-owned blockade runners carrying war goods to the South and then taking cotton to Europe would serve two important missions, excuse me. First, the government would have 100% of the cargo space for importing desperately needed arms and munitions. And second, the return cargo of cotton would provide funds in Europe for the purchase of ships and arms. It was a simple but brilliant proposal. Unfortunately, now here's where I'm starting to wonder if certain things were torpedoed when it looked like one side might get the edge too early. It
mm-hmm.
states, unfortunately, the Confederate government delayed 3 years before implementing it. And by then, the Southern cause was all but lost. Now, moving on just real quickly,
uh-huh.
there was an episode at this time where Britain nearly jumped in to, the Civil War, I guess you could say, and it was the second time they threatened it, as far as I know. This was the first of the two.
Right.
There was something called the Trent Affair.
Yeah.
And it said here...
it was the Council of Trent.
Oh, no, this was a ship that was involved.
Oh, a ship.
Yeah,
okay.
Here we go. I got it. It said, The Trent Affair reversed Mallory's idea on iron ship construction and contributed to such a confusion on cruiser commands so as to endanger the ships. Briefly, a United States Navy vessel stopped the Trent, a British passenger ship on the high seas, in November 1861 and forcibly removed John Slidell and James Mason, Confederate diplomats, en route to Europe. And then it stated that the action was a flagrant violation of British sovereignty and of international law. And for a few weeks, war between Great Britain and the United States, States seemed imminent. Cut to the chase, the reason why it didn't happen was Lincoln, obviously, or whether this was his idea or he was told to do this, told his naval people, let him go.
Right.
They let him go, and then Queen, I guess it was Victoria at the time, was she in there?
I think it was Victoria, yeah.
So she basically said, okay, that's great, and found greater favor with the Union cause, and so there was no more friction. So Slidell obviously was a pawn then in this Trent Affair, and it did not say if he were good nor bad, but I think later on it talks about Slidell again, but here we find him obviously being a pivotal character in what's been a really long forgotten episode in the Civil War.
Yeah, well, what you just said about the shipping and everything,
yes,
that falls right into Emmanuel Josephson's book that I have right in front of me, and I just happened to have that page open, I don't know why, and you started talking about that, and I'm looking down the bottom of the page, and it says, and let me quote it, there was none of the blatant fraud in the dealings of the Rothschild interests with the Union that characterized those of other bankers and commercial Native American interests. That means, you know, the Rothschilds, there was no fraud on their part. Now it says, banker John P. Morgan, for example, swindled the government out of huge sums by selling back to it at enormous profits worthless and condemned rifles that he had arranged to purchase from it for that purpose. Now there's your shipment of rifles that came over.
Yep.
Nor was there any defrauding of the government by the Rothschilds by defaulting on payment to the government of monies deposited with their firm, as in the instance of the Wildcat Banks. Now, this is what I'm talking about, the 1935 era, all the way up to the 1840s. I mean, 1835 to 1840s,
right,
with the Wildcat swindles. With their firm, as in the instance of the Wildcat Banks, okay, nevertheless, there has been directed against the Rothschilds a constant stream of calumny that has two prime purposes. One is the efforts of vicious and malign conspirators to divert attention from their criminal activities by propaganda directed by them and paid or subsidized agents against others, such as the Rothschilds.
Now, what you just read also, if I got this correct, that would mean that the Morgan family was involved in this global enterprise,
yes,
even before Rockefeller and Carnegie came on the scene. Rockefeller would soon come on the scene, but Morgan really was...
Oh, yeah, yeah. And guess who, when I had the organizational structure of the Black Pope.
Right, the Jesuit general.
And under their control is J.P. Morgan, Rothschilds, Roosevelt. You wouldn't believe the people that are under and operating in the Jesuits today.
Well,
the admiral of the Pentagon, the chief top counsel of the Pentagon, is run by the Jesuit Adolfo Nicolás.
Well, you know, I just want to explain something too. We had Eric John Phelps on, whose work you're now acquainted with. And somebody said, you know, it seems he's got Jesuits in the Vatican under every Bush and Hill and such. And I understand it. And in a sense, that's the case. But let's just take an example. You can talk about the CIA and that construct, but then you're really talking about under the aegis
that's
under
the
which they operate is Knights of Malta.
Yeah, the Knights of Malta, the Knights of Columbus. They operate and own the NWO, the WWF, all the banks of the world. Every bank is run and controlled by the Black Pope, and UNESCO, the World Council of Churches.
Oh, yeah, please.
You know, I mean, you name it, they're there.
Well, what we're saying, though, and in whatever, you know, Phelps doesn't ask me to defend him, and sometimes he throws around his favorite term is anybody who looks like they might be something, he calls them a temporal coadjutor.
And
you know, and he might even be right, but the thing is, to me, it does mess things up a bit. My point is this. They've been at this for centuries. They've got it locked up, but why would you go ahead and leave footprints that lead back to you? So you don't have to talk about the Vatican, and really the force behind the Vatican is the Society of Jesus, the Sons of Loyola.
Right.
All right. And so we don't have to talk about it all the time, but when people ask me who sits on top of the dung pile, I'm going, those are the people.
That's right.
And it comes out of Rome, you know, which is a nation state. Vatican is a nation state, as people forget about this. So, yes, I mean, they have got it locked, and they've got other minions and organizations to do their work and to hide their footprints.
Yeah.
But the hardest sell for this, I-Man, is in the United States.
Canadians are
hip to this. Europeans are extremely aware of this.
It's
only here that the blinders have been put on us for an obvious reason.
That's like I've gotten emails, and most of the email stuff, nothing comes from the United States. It's from Austria, and Germany, and the last one I got was, he was from Impasetter is his email, I know he comes from Europe, but where in Europe, I don't know. He didn't say. And these people are well-versed in this aspect of it, but the people over here in the United States, they're as dumb as a bump on a log, and you know,
part of that also has been that we have been heavily bailed from looking at that. That's one thing.
Yeah.
But when other people try to say, listen, this is the case, and here you have, in this situation, you have centuries of documents written by those who were participants, who were observers of the perfidies of the Vatican backed by the Jesuits. And but that's also disposed with because it doesn't fit into their paradigm, therefore it cannot be true.
Right. But see, in England and in Europe, they're well known. I mean, that's where they live. You know, over here they don't. In fact, I did a research on the Vatican, the Pope, you know, the Catholic Church. They have a following of 1 billion. One billion. What religion
claims that
in the world has 1 billion followers?
Well, some would say Islam does, but I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah.
I mean, we were being told it is because, again, just like you said before, we are headed for another war that eventually will come down to the cause of religious problems or incompatibilities. So we're going to have a third world war, and it's going to wind up being religious. And as you had read from, I guess it was Morse?
Yeah, Morse.
That if you get into a religious squabble, it is the bloodiest. It is definitely a war of extermination.
Oh, yeah, that's what the Crusades was about in the 1300s.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's on the fence or isn't really sure about a conflagration, if it finally winds up to be a religious thing, they're right behind it.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's an emotional issue that definitely puts everybody over the edge. Not everybody, but, I mean, obviously, it swings toward the people who would not necessarily be backing war to go ahead and say, oh, it's for that cause? Okay, I'm behind it. Just like they did with the Civil War, holding up slavery as the cause.
Well, here's if any of your listeners want to get this book, is called Sources of the Constitution of the United States, Considered in Relation to Colonial and English History, by C. Ellis Stevens, LLD, DLC, Edinburgh, and is printed in New York, Macmillan and Company, and London, 1927.
All right, let me
just... You know, if people can't write that fast, it's just look for Sources, Constitution of the United States.
Well, let me tell you what happened, because that book is coming to me via interlibrary loan.
Oh, it is.
So I'm going to at least be able to be a borrower for a time and hopefully for a re-up. I didn't think the interlibrary loan person at the university had a shot at this because it was 1927, because it was originally printed, published rather, in England. But sure enough, there are...
They had it, huh?
Yeah.
Good.
And
well, go to page 153, and I'm going to read it.
Okay.
Two European potentiates, the German emperor and the pope, were at the time of the convention elected by small bodies of men, in one case even called electors.
Yep.
Sir Henry Maine thinks that the members of the convention, we're talking about our convention over here in the Constitution, they were making it up, right, were to a considerable extent guided by the example of the Holy Roman Empire. The American Republican electors, he goes so far as to say, are the German imperial electors, except they are chosen by the several states. The state governors and the national president are the stat holders, S-T-A-T-H-O-L-D-E-Rs, of the states and the United States, as the governors were officials created by the charters granted to English colonies by English sovereigns, the calling them stat holders and implying that they had a Dutch beginning is somewhat ludicrous.
So that was window dressing.
Yeah. So the founding fathers did not write the Constitution. They were given it to them and they adopted it. Now, if anybody wants to look up the word adoption in Webster's 1828 dictionary, they're in for a shock, because when the founding fathers stated they adopted it, it meant that they took the contract already written as if they did it.
Right.
And that's it.
So the use of adoption.
People better learn to read a dictionary like a novel.
Yeah, as a mystery, so
yeah.
to speak. Yeah. And that's also, and I'm just going to mention this now, I believe that you address that also in the newest book that's coming out, The Constitution for the United States, The Myth and the Reality.
The myth and the reality.
Just who owns the U.S.
Yeah.
Okay. And we'll talk about that more next time out, but that book will soon be available, folks, and we'll tell you more about that later. Now, I have to tell you, I was talking to Phelps about this off mic, and he absolutely dismisses that. But you have to remember something, too, and this is okay. I mean, this is the way it goes. Phelps is a staunch defender of the purity of George Washington, the Constitution, God breathe, you know, wonderful Christians. And I was there also, but I found that it did not wash when I looked at their behavior and what took place.
Right.
So therefore, you know, he and I will have to have a discussion about this. And he'll do that. And that's okay, you know. But,
yeah.
I mean, I believe the way he did. And I said, no, this is a fairy tale, too. Don't tell me that.
But, right, because what it is people have been brainwashed by myths all their lives. For 221 years, that we the people created the Constitution, right? Meaning the common man, which is a myth right there. We placed in there our servants who are representatives, which is Congress. That's another myth. They are representing the corporation. And I had found in one of the publications in Europe that the United States, I mean, when I read it, I fell on the floor. I mean, here is people in Europe telling, you know, the people reading the book that how the Washington, D.C. was set up as was the city of London that had no connection whatsoever to the people in what they call the states today, and it's one big corporation.
Yeah, what we're saying, and okay, I mean, I've said that that's what it looked like to me without us ever having spoken about this, but what the city of London is to London and Great Britain, D.C. is to the United States.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean,
it even goes in and lays out the history as to what the myth of 1871 creating a corporation when it was already a corporation. a lot of patriots you read on, on the internet, and they're arguing, oh, well, the United States was formed and the United States of America was formed as a corporation in 1871. That is not true, because the documents that I have goes all the way back to 1836, and it proves that it was a corporation because the United States, which was Congress, which is just front men for the corporation, bought the city of Alexandria, Washington, D.C., and Georgetown when they went bankrupt in 1824.
How could that be?
They were corporations then. And people think it's a government. We have never had a government. We have been dealing with corporations all of our lives, and people are under the myth and misconception that it's a government. It is not. It is just like dealing with GM or Westinghouse or Walmart.
Well, let me ask you then, after the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, or at least adopted it.
They adopted it,
all right, after they passed, who became the beneficiaries of the Constitution from that period onward?
The Pope and the King and the bank, because they all had a part and parcel of the money that was invested in the Virginia Company.
All right, but you know,
they weren't about to lose that. So when they formed a subcorporation called the United States, they were the beneficiaries and just took the monies that they were supposed to pay, because it's right in the Internal Revenue Code, and it's right in the 6209 that you can pull out the individual master file, and in there is a blocking code 300, which that money goes directly, and it's in Title 26, I think it's 1426 section, that money goes directly to the Bank of England.
Well, we've said this on another time, that for the most part, we're ruled, we the little people, by all these other documents, if you will, and legal documents or otherwise.
Right.
That, like you said, Title 26, you can go look here. And so that's really what we're being governed by.
Uh-huh.
But let me ask you, with the Constitution and with these amendments, of course it does look like we have constitutional protections.
Yeah.
What's the deal with the amendments? I'll let you explain that.
Well, the amendments, you're talking about the first 10 amendments?
Well, even those that have come on. I mean, what in the world has got prohibition got to do with anything? And you know, so.
Oh, yeah, that has, if you go back in history, what is the first thing they taxed was alcohol?
The Whiskey Rebellion, yeah.
The Whiskey Rebellion, yeah. Yep.
Well.
So you have to go back into history. And the Patriots they can see as far as the end of the nose, and that's it. You get these people like the Pope, the King, the bankers, they look centuries down the road before their kids are even born. That's what they're looking for. Today, it's me. I ain't worried about my grand. Oh, I like to say, you know, it sounds good. Oh, my grandkids and my great-grandkids are going to be paying all this money and everything. That's as far as they look. That's just window dressing what they're saying. They're not really thinking about it. But these other people who are doing and the doers, they're wanting what's going to happen centuries from now, and what they plan to happen, they carry it out. We don't.
I want to get back to the Civil War, and I want to tie in some of the things that I had mentioned to you, so it makes some kind of sense, at least not only in your mind, but the listeners' minds and my mind as well. But but here's where if I'm not extrapolating, I'm interpolating, if you will, and
right.
That is, it seems to me that when the United States went through this banking period that was conducive for the United States, but not necessarily for the old world.
Right.
That eventually, and here's what I was saying about the Knights of the Golden Circle, and they may not be the only ones, but it seems as there were plans perhaps 10 to 15 years ahead of time, maybe even 20, if we're talking about the 30s and such, where it was like, okay, you guys go ahead and have fun for a decade or two, but we're going to finally come in and kneecap you guys and make sure that the way that this country operates after this civil war is over is going to be much easier for we, the old world powers, to manipulate.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And now, isn't it interesting also, if you think back, there were two, I'm calling them assassinations. One of them was failed, and that is, isn't it interesting that they went after Zachary Taylor?
Right.
I'm assuming Taylor may not have been big into wanting to go into Texas and such, so he gets, well, okay, he died of natural causes, right, after a year in office, and Tyler does what he wouldn't. But then later on, you have an attempt at his inauguration to kill Buchanan.
Yeah.
And Charles T. Wilcox, in his book, The Transformation of the Republic, and he's also the source of those images you have of the papal bull, he has in his book a headline from a New York Daily that said, you know, Buchanan's party poisoned. So, I mean, this is not even, you know, people go, well, why isn't it in history books? Don't start with that. So you have two assassination attempts, I think, because they exhumed Taylor, the Oak Ridge laboratory did, and said, oh, no, that's the natural amount of arsenic you find in a body. Okay. So, you know, you got one poison, definitely. Get the other one that they hide. So here you have two assassinations. What is going on between the old world and new world that you see this kind of activity with heads of state? And, of course, they were successful with Lincoln. And then within what? 16 years or so? They whacked Garfield. And then they whack McKinley. I mean, look at this. Five assassinations in less than 50 years.
Right.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. So that must have been a very tempestuous time where if there was any resistance to the old world in the United States, certainly, if you'll excuse the phraseology, the old world had to kick some ass and take some names.
Right. Yeah, and that's what they were doing. Now, a real short... In this encyclopedia that I have on national public finance, it's real short.
Okay.
And it's only like two columns, but I'm just going to skip. They start out with 1789 to 1800, where Hamilton's report on the public credit placed the total public debt outstanding at $77 million. I'm not going to say all the rest. Foreign debt was 11. Domestic debt was 40. State debts was $25 million. And... then the bank was chartered in 1791, and you go to page 123 to look, and you get even more info. And then the Mint Act was provided the decimal system of coinage in 1792. And now here's where the crown comes in very nicely, because that is where they valued the U.S. dollar at 24.75 grains of gold and established bimetallism with silver and gold legal tender of a ratio of 15 to 1. Today, it's 70 to 1.
Yeah.
Established a mint in Philly. And then it goes up to 1822 to 1829, where there were surpluses. In 1826, it was a serious inconvenience because the treasury was overflowing. 1830 to 1835, land speculation made the over 7 million, reduced it by 1832, and the entire debt was paid off January 1835. All the debt. There was no debt whatsoever. Now, the second Coinage Act changed the ratio to 16 to 1. You see how the crown is manipulating it?
Yeah.
Because there is no such thing as a gold standard, because what they did, and it's in the book, I forget what page number, but what Josephson said, what they did with manipulation of, once the king told them the currency act that they had to use gold and silver at a ratio of 35 to 1, they changed it. And the crown bank took over everything and changed the ratio and did everything, you know, so it really screwed the people of America in using gold and silver, because they were at the mercy of the bank.
But you know what this reminds me of? It's an issue of the slavery we've all been in. And this is with, obviously, due respect to those peoples who have been actually placed in manacles killed, yeah, mistreated, whatever. But all of us, in a sense, financially or under the economy, have been placed in slavery. And what you mentioned is what is like what Pharaoh did with the tribes. It's like, okay, you guys are really doing well making the bricks or whatever, so we're going to give you less straw.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It's just like if everything's going well, we can't have that, and we want to obviously raise the ante, if you will.
Right. Now, in here they say the independent treasury system was established in 1840. Discontinued 1841, reestablished 1846, continued until merged with the Federal Reserve System in 1913, and finally abolished 1921 by the Act of 1920. Well, gee, what happened? After they put it in 1846, the annual surpluses reappeared. 1844 to 1846, yeah, annual surpluses reappeared. 1850 to 1857, a period of large surpluses. This is on banking now, public finance. The Coinage Act reduced silver in all small coins except for the dollar and authorized coinage of $3 gold pieces in 1853. Then the Civil War in 1865 led to the introduction of a variety of taxes. An income tax for the first time was enacted 5 August 1861. Rates were 3% on incomes excess of $800. Now, here's what's interesting that this book don't tell you, that I had to go in and search it and find it. And in the first income tax, they had to eliminate Section 210 because it taxed everybody. And all the people that were still alive from the Civil War, from the Revolutionary War, complained so much that they had to reduce and take that section out and only taxed the U.S. government employees for taking money from the public treasury to pay them. It was a kickback.
Right.
Just like Frank Kowalik had said in his book that he published a little while ago, IRS Humbug. Now, and then it said, internal revenue surpassed custom duties as a source of government revenue. By 1865, the income tax produced almost 20% of the total federal receipts, and manufacturers and sales taxes amounted to 23%. And then it goes on talking about the greenbacks, and the Treasury issued 26 million legal tender notes by purchasing bonds, and the income tax expired in 1872. And then it just goes through all the way up to, this book was printed in 1955, and it came up to 1952, where slight surpluses were recorded. And 53 to 60, the total budget expenditures, oh, it does go to 1960.
But in essence, what we're talking about is that, again, as we even said earlier on about this whole issue, how we introduced the program, and that is when things are going well for us, for you, for me, for
right,
our cohorts.
Uh-huh.
That's not good for the powers that be, and you also don't have an element of control, which they want very badly. So
yeah,
all that had to go because it worked for us.
Right.
And now we're seeing what I think, well, I'm going to ask you your comment on this, what is taking place, what happened last year and will happen again this year, continued.
Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing perhaps what might be the final death knell for any chance we have of getting out from, quote, under it?
Yeah, that is really true, because even in this book, on the banking and the capital markets, they go in and talk about the second bank when it was chartered and who chartered it. Alexander Dallas, Stephen Girard, and John Jacob Astor. All controlled by the Jesuits. All of them.
And if you believe this account, and I do, they went ahead and they whacked Astor also.
Oh, that's right.
On the Titanic.
Uh-huh. And in 1823 to 1826, Nicholas Biddle succeeded the presidency of the original bank, and they were banknotes were issued, and so much money and loans to the U.S. government. You know, here is the people sitting in the background, the Black Pope, loaning money to the government, sucking out the money from that interest, which was usury. That is the term for interest, is usury.
Right.
And the, 1838, the Free Banking Act, it goes through the whole thing. And the establishment of the Federal Reserve was to remedy the defects of the national banking system, the inelasticity of the currency, need for the lender of last resort to come to the aid of commercial banks where there was a drain on reserves demonstrated by the Panic of 1907. So Morgan Stanley and Company in the first position, and Morgan and Stanley Company was also under the control of the international bankers and the Jesuits, because the Pope and the international bankers and the Black Pope today control all banks in the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to be a wise guy too, but Nelson Biddle also made it possible for the Mayflower, madam. If you
yeah.
and actually, there's a certain kind of, I guess, what would you call it, irony there, because what she provided and what he provided screwed the rest
yeah.
of us.
Yeah. Biddle was, you know, he was he was put there to control it, just like
yes.
Admiral Mullen of the Pentagon is there. And he's the chief, joint chiefs of staff. He's the chief guy. And Adolfo Nicholas, who was just installed as the Black Pope in January of 2009, he is running the Pentagon. And naturally, because of what's going on in Iran and Afghanistan, and Egypt and Israel, and, who knows what they're going to do?
Oh, we know what's going to what they're going to do. And I mean, I don't. I've said it enough so that it need not be. But I guess I'll allude to it. And that is, I look at this and I see a script that they ran prior to World War II and World War I.
Yeah, because they created World War I and World War II.
Yeah. And you're looking at you have to have a financial problem to begin with, and then eventually, within about a decade or so, the United States finds itself in a major conflagration. So. I think
oh,
that's
yeah.
what we're looking at, and I think, like we talked about the instigation in the 30s prior to the Civil War,
uh-huh.
I think we're seeing instigations here also for what might be also an internal civil war as well, depending on how you view what's going on with regard to the invasion that we've had, the soft invasion by Latinos.
Right.
And we're not blaming them, but the thing is, they're also
yeah.
being used as well. But here you go again with a Romanist people who are being used as the Irish were used prior to Civil War. So,
uh-huh.
I mean, here you go.
Yeah.
They keep running the same thing because it works.
That's right.
And I have to say, in deference to people who are always looked upon less than favorably because of that saying, history repeats itself.
Mm-hmm.
Really what we're talking about, though, also, is that there's a history that repeats itself that they're not really privy to in the public fool system.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And what I found out after I wrote about it in the new book, but I've since then found other info that I couldn't put in the book because it was in the process of being printed and finalized and everything, and I wasn't about to put all the documents that I had in there. But when Walter Buren sent me the audit of 2000 of the IRS,
right.
the GAO does two audits on the IRS. Two.
On the IRS?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason why they do it is because it's a private corporation. They first do... And the Treasury has first dibs and does the audit on the collection process that they have collected, what they collected, and all that. Now, this is already on the net, and you can probably go in and get it, because Walter sent it to me. And then the GAO does it on the corporation of called the IRS itself. And in the report, he sent me... It said that they were a private foreign corporation.
Huh.
Well, way back in 1994 and that, I did a request from the Secretary of State of Nevada and North Carolina, and I asked them specifically to provide me the documentation that allowed these corporations to operate in the state. And that was the Federal Reserve System, any way that I could do it. The Federal Reserve Corporation, the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Bureau. And I got back from Edmonston in North Carolina, who was the Secretary of State, that there is no authorization for these companies to participate in operating in North Carolina. And I got the same thing from Nevada with a gold seal on it and everything that comes from the Secretary of State. Okay. So what I did was I said to GAO, I called them, I emailed them, and I sent them a document that I said I wanted to know what country was the IRS chartered in. And, of course, you know, December 15th, and I get all these runarounds and, well, we didn't see that you sent it to the proper party and all this, and we forwarded it to the proper party. Well, all the way up till January the 24th, I never got the proper party. But then I did finally get in touch with the one guy there, and he says, well, and he gives the old standard,
yada, yada,
you know,
right.
Runaround that you get from anybody else. And then I finally pinned him down, and I says, look, it's either England or Italy. Where are they chartered? Well, another guy named Young came back on, and he got this high and mighty thing that, the standard story you get, yada, 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 the IRS is a government and company and all this and everything. Well, I said, wait a minute. I says, your report says David Walker signed off on it, and he was a controller of the United States, controller general for the money. And he said they were a foreign private corporation. Now, what I want to know is, did the Vatican charter the IRS? Well, the Vatican's in Italy. Well, man, they clammed up and they won't talk to me, and they said they will never respond to any of these questions again.
Okay.
Well, hey, so I says, all right, I'm going to find it. So I went back in, and like when I had the Geneva Convention books of 1930, and I had gone into it, I put some of it on ATG Press, but I did have the books. I had to give them back to the guy. I only had 30 days to look at them. And I scanned what I could, and in the three volumes, they come in three volumes, and it stated and showed that in 1930, IRS was installed in every European country.
All right, now what book expressly did this come from?
The Geneva books of 1930.
All right, now is that part available on ATG Press?
Yeah, I put as much as I could in there, and it shows that the United States was not bankrupt at all. They were forgiving all kinds of debts from Germany, from Norway, from France. I mean, you know, it's like, hey, we forgive this $1 billion debt you owe us, you know, and all this. Well, if you're bankrupt, why ain't you claiming your money that you loaned out to these countries?
All right, so the bankruptcy was a scam.
It was a scam.
All right, and then what did it continue to say in the Geneva papers about the IRS?
It showed where, and it gave names and cities and everything where they were formed. And if they were formed here by Congress, like all the patriots believe, you know, some of them don't, but why are they installing our IRS in these foreign countries? For what reason?
All right, so
Libya, Liberia, Ethiopia, Egypt, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Turkey, France.
But as what we call them here, and that is a collection agency for a private corporation,
right.
That's what they are in these other countries. And so
yes.
Who are they collecting the funds for?
The Pope. You know why? Because what tenet of the church says that no man can have possessions And what is the only man that runs and owns every country of the world under the tenets of the church?
All right, so for public consumption, it is the Pope, the Vicar of Christ.
Yeah, He claims to be the Vicar of Christ, but he's not.
No, because he said he was, that's why.
Yeah, just because he said he was. He's some educated man that could read way back when the church was first created, and all the people were so dumb they couldn't read. And so he claimed that he was the Vicar of Christ, and everybody's got to follow him. Hey, it's worked. Look at he's got 1 billion followers today.
And let's remember something also, and I think this was, again, just a great PR photo op. The outgoing Jesuit general, Koldenbach,
right,
went to Ratzinger, I believe it was Ratzinger, Benedict, and asked Benedict if he could retire, and that is an absolute laugh.
Right.
Because it's the other way around. But at least for public consumption, once again, it seemed that Koldenbach was in subordination to the Pope, and that is not the case.
No, no. Because, you see, the white Pope and the black Pope, they're two different entities. And many a white Pope has been killed by the black Popes because they didn't kowtow to what they wanted to do, because they run the Vatican.
Well, I think it was clear that the last time this happened was with John Paul I.
Yes, it was.
Who stumbled into the financial scandal and had to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And interestingly, I'm surprised that Godfather III was allowed to come out to really show that in a fictionalized form, but it was based really on that scam.
Yeah, well, I know there's a good book, but you can get downloaded on the internet. It is by one of the Jesuits, Edmund Parrish.
Yes, that's right.
And I haven't read it yet. I just downloaded it, and it gives the whole history of the Jesuits. You know, when they were formed, the first De Loyola was in 1846 or a little bit before 1846.
Yep.
Is when the black popes were installed. Before then, it was just the white popes.
Yeah, and there was a power struggle that went on, and the Jesuits or the Sons of Loyola, the Society of Jesus, whatever you want to call them, had not necessarily found favor early on, and there was a struggle that went on for some time, but that struggle is well over.
Yes, oh, well over, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, people in America never exposed to this are going to say, you're crazy. What, you know, what are you talking about, a black pope? Is he black? I have people ask me. Well, it's a black man. I says, no, it's not a black man. I says, they can't wear white robes. They all wear black.
Right.
I says, that's why, and people don't realize this, but the white pope in 1355 chartered the ABA in this country. Not this country, but the ABA.
Is an extension.
Yeah, they became, in 1355, was the year that all the lawyers got together and formed what they call the bar.
Right.
Now, if you read and see the definition of a lawyer, an attorney, he is a bar. It doesn't mean British accredited regency like some people say.
Right.
A bar is one attorney only. Charles Warren, in the history of the American bar, brings this out very clearly, that when you're talking about an attorney, you're talking about a bar. It's another name for an attorney, a bar. Why bar? I have no idea. But anyway, they chartered the English bar because the Knights Templar were attorneys of the Pope.
As well as bankers,
Pope.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The white Pope, mm-hmm. not the bankers, but the white Pope itself, because the Knights Templar were the bank of the Pope.
That's what I meant, that they were bankers as well as attorneys.
Yeah. And then what happened is, over here, when the Jesuits took over the Vatican and runs it, it's a corporation. That's all it is. Just a corporation,
and you know,
that controls everything and gets all of its money from foreign countries,
just
every country that they operate in. And that's why they want to destroy republics, because republics are supposed to be the word of the Lord, and the Jesuits are to destroy the word of the Lord so that the Pope, white Pope, can rule. They actually protect the white Pope.
Also,
but the way that they've got it is every judge that you see today wears black robes because his boss, his higher authority, is the black Pope.
All right, and this is what I was, I'm sorry for stepping on you, but you went exactly where I wanted to go. And this had been pointed out to me by one of the listeners, Freak Lemon, up in Pennsylvania. But it's very clear if you take a look at it, regardless what Christian church you're in, whether it's Catholic or Protestant, no matter what synod, it doesn't make a difference what particular branch.
So whether you're a Baptist or Episcopalian, or it doesn't matter.
But it's also much more prevalent in mainstream churches, and that is when you take a look at a courtroom setup and you take a look at your church's setup, it is very much the same with the judge as the pastor or priest or whatever, the different levels inside the building, and that is symbolic beyond your wildest dreams.
Right.
So, I mean, there you go.
And if you notice, that I have looked at it, and I don't go to church. My church is just like the Lord said, you know, you go to a corner, that's your church. You don't need to have a building.
Right,
church
I
is not a building, you know. But if you look at your churches today, what do you see flying in there?
Yeah, it's a gold,
the gold-fringed American flag.
Of a 501c3 church that took the cheese from the government.
That's right.
That's right. Now, everything's going all right now, but I tell you, there'll come a day, and then we'll see what happens.
Yes.
Most of the churches are dead, so there'll never be a conflict. But sooner or later, there are churches who obviously are Bible-behaving, Bible-believing, and they're going to have a choice to make.
Well, see, that's one of the things for the South, too, because they call it the Bible Belt, where the North wasn't too much a Bible Belt. But that's why they had the war, and the Jesuits were for, believe it or not, the South. It was a Bible Belt that believed in the word of the Lord and what he said. It's very strange that the way they operated this.
Well,
but the end result is what they wanted.
Exactly.
Bringing them back into it, completely obliterating them so they could get the 16th, the 14th Amendment in 1868,
right.
and then reconfiguring and reconstructing the entire country. The entire principles of the country was in 1868 under the Reconstruction Act, started March 1st.
That's because it turned states into districts.
Yes.
All right, I don't know if we spoke about this on air, but...
Yeah, they did, but it was Washington that actually turned the states into districts in 1792.
But there was a terminology that was used in the Reconstruction Acts, and because they were in the Union at the time, after obviously being allowed back in...
Oh, yeah.
They were termed something, and that also put that same status on every state that would ever be admitted to the Union again.
Yeah, because that's why they said that under the Constitution, no state could be lesser than any of the other states, and that's why they had to bring the North in and make those states slave states the same as the South. In other words, slave states as far as the people being controlled.
Yes.
They had to be on the same plane level.
But what was the word you used? Was it territories? That was the,
territories.
The verbiage? Okay. So although ostensibly it was supposed to be directed towards those 11 Confederate states.
Right.
Because I think Tennessee was exempt from that. But anyway, I mean, in a sense it was, at least in the Reconstruction period. But what that really did was paint all states from that point on.
The same.
They all
had to be on the same level.
So backhandedly, rather than
bringing the southern states to the level of the northern states, they knocked the northern states down to the level of the southern states.
And hence, as they said,
made everybody, a 14th Amendment citizen.
Right. And the old story about, cynically said, but I think true, and that is the 13th Amendment supposedly freed the slaves, the 14th enslaved everybody.
Well, the 13th, the original that I did the work with David Dodge on that, and
the nobility?
Yeah, and that was there, and it still does exist, but it's never been put in. What they did was all the history books, when I spent, hours, days in North Carolina Chapel Hills Law School. I found all, I was doing it for Dodge because he didn't have a lot of the eastern states done, and I did it for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, North Carolina, and I didn't get to the other states, but some of the other people did that was up in Maine and all that. They did get Maine, but, you know, Massachusetts and Rhode Island, they didn't get that. But I spent time, and I found the original in North Carolina and New Jersey constitutions, not the first one, it's not there, but the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth come all the way up to 1846. And then it stopped. There's no mention of the 13th Amendment after 1846 in the North Carolina Law Library. In all the books that I got, every year it kept going until all of a sudden, 1846, hey, look, guys, there was one guy with me. I says, it's not, it's gone, right. 1846. So let's stop here and let's go every book from 1846, wherever the Constitution was redone, and follow it. And bingo, there's the 13th Amendment before 1868.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is they dropped off that because at that particular point in time, because all the presidents are elected by the Pope as to who's going to be the next president. It's not the people. The people had no idea. That's another myth.
Right.
We vote representatives in. They represent, just like Lysander Spooner said, they represent the corporation. They do not represent you. Because if I go to, say, Senator Dodd, and you go to Senator Dodd, and we're directly opposite, who's he going to listen to?
Neither.
He's going to say, like Spooner said, where's the contract? Where is it that I said I was going to do what you told me to do?
Mm-hmm.
There's no contract.
There is none.
I don't have any. I don't even know you. Get out of here. I'm going to vote for the corporation to keep the corporation viable. And that's it. That's my sole purpose.
Yeah, and people can't understand why the representatives aren't more responsive.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why.
Like Schultz. Schultz will never, never, ever get what he wants because they do not represent, and, all right, his grievances or whatever he wants. It's just like going to GM and say, hey, I want you to sell me a car for $3,000. Get lost, buddy. You don't. You're not part of this corporation.
Right.
Yeah, but I am so and so and so. Oh yeah, prove it. Where's your signature on the contract called the Constitution?
Well, Bob Schultz's intentions are good, but the thing is, he's bringing it to a place where it falls on deaf ears. I mean,
that's right.
And that's D.C. I mean, it's crazy to go ahead and protest in D.C. because it's got nothing to do with what
right.
you know really are in people's hearts, the issues that
sure.
are there. No.
That's just like Obama, you know, and Berg and all those people. They went to the court, right? What court did they go to?
I know.
They went to the Pope's court. They went, believe it or not, all courts in this country are ecclesiastical courts. And people always, like Howard Freeman, used to say, well, what kind of a court is it? Is it a statutory court? Is it a constitutional court? Is it, you know, he went everything, and he did not hit ecclesiastical courts.
Well, this goes back to what you were saying about the chartering of the bar in England.
Right.
It goes back to the Vatican.
The Knights Templar of the Pope, not the Black Pope, because remember, the Black Pope didn't come into existence until the 1840s.
Right.
It was the White Pope, and it was ecclesiacal, and you know, there was no what you call a real court or a court like you got today until the king in 1774 bought in the First Court Act. It's in my new book. I can't remember the name of it.
What, the Act?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It's the Act of the Courts of they bought in because all the people, the colonists at that time, said, "We have no courts." Well, they had courts, and they were the common law courts of England under the English king. But they were so widespread and could be named whatever they wanted to name them and have different people sitting on it and everything, that they bought in the first act in 1774 on the courts, so that the people would have something to operate with.
All right, then how does that fit in with, would that be called the Administration of Justice Act?
Yeah.
Okay. And you can find that on avalon.law.yale.edu, huh?
Uh-huh. Yeah, because see, what I did was in my book, I put, when I went to first think about doing the book, I went to a major publisher and I says, "Hey, I've got something here, and I want to know how much it costs to print this book." And I says, they says, "Well, you're going to put all the documents that you have in there?" I said, "Yeah." And I told them all the documents I have. You know what that book would cost? $2,600. It would be 15 pounds, 4 inches thick, 8 by 11, tissue paper thin, 5,000 pages.
Right.
Patriot wouldn't even be able to afford to pay the shipping on it.
Right. Well,
so I cut it down, and in the book, I cited various sites that they could go on the internet to get some of the documents. The others they couldn't, because they'd have to go to a regular library to get it, and they're too lazy to do that. So I didn't bother putting that in there. But
right. Well, that Avalon site is very interesting because it
does
have
Avalon
all of this stuff.
Very, yeah, the Avalon is very, very interesting. Now, here's one thing that I will tell you on the book, and I know you got the book, but go to page 71, 72, and I'm going to read you. I do put it on the ATG Press on this particular one.
Okay.
And from the North Carolina State Archives, it mentions the king. "For remember, all states were still under British Pope Crown can rule. The Carolina Charter Corporation was created by another corporation, the Crown and the King's Corporation, to do business in his name in this country. The corporation of the king was recognized by the 1783 Treaty of Paris." Now, the case in here is Marshall versus Lovelace and U.S. versus Chamberlain and the Dollar Savings Bank. Now, I'm going to read you a small quote from the Dollar Savings Bank in 1783. This is 100 years after the treaty.
Right.
"Statutes of general purport do not apply to the United States unless Congress makes an application clear and indisputable. That means that the legislatures can write any statute they want, but they cannot include the United States or attorneys into that so that they could be sued."
And
that's
by,
what it says.
By United States, we're referring to?
The corporation.
Okay.
Now, in the court, is what they instructed. The rule thus settled respecting the British Crown, well, you can't sue the United States, that's a British Crown, actually, different name, is equally applicable to this government, and it has been applied frequently in the different states and practically in the federal courts. It may be considered as settled that so much of the royal prerogatives belonging to the king in his capacity, parens parte, or universal trustee, enters as much into our political state as it does into the principles of the British Constitution. Now, this was cited in a case, money laundering case in 1999, United States of America versus Sonia Evett Singleton. And it was in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And they said, "We now hold 18 U.S.C. 201(c)(2) does not apply to the United States or an assistant United States attorney functioning within the official scope of the office." Right there. That is telling you that the Pope's attorneys will not be sued when performing the business of the corporation of the King Pope Bank called the United States.
And a lot of
there
people,
is your immunity
right.
that the judges claim they have.
Now, in speaking about this courts, and you said it to me, but let's do this for the purpose of everyone. We understand courts to be that of admiralty. How does that fit into the scheme?
Okay. International law of Hammurabi is admiralty. It goes back to 1600 B.C. All of the crown's possessions outside of England are in foreign countries. They need the sea to go to there to operate, and that is the law of Hammurabi that the ecclesiastical courts use, and why the United States Constitution and the First Judiciary Act was stated that the sole purpose of any court is admiralty and will abide by admiralty rules under Hammurabi.
So
because of the international mercantile Congress, transportation, and dealings in mercantile law.
So this came in during 1600 B.C. is because then we saw the proliferation of seagoing commercial.
Yes. And Hammurabi was in the law of Babylon. And that's where all countries operated from because everybody used the sea to deal with each other.
Right.
And so Australia and England, the United States and England, the Philippines, anything, the Fiji Islands, Barbados, wherever the king, Grenada, look at Grenada, that's still an island off of South America that is still the crown's possession.
Gee, you know, that makes me wonder why in the world we went in there unless it was to kick out the Cubans and the Angolans that the crown didn't want there.
That's right. Yeah.
And again, then when we
well,
had...
Well, that's why the Black Pope now is in control of the Pentagon. He can use that billion-dollar, $5 billion monstrosity of where the Pope had its own armies before. All they used was the American United States Army conglomeration because he owns it.
And that's why I think the idea always was not to divide the United States with what is called the Civil War,
right.
but to provide a message as a vehicle of control, because
uh-huh.
I think it was known that the United States military would be used for other purposes throughout the 20th century, which was clear from the beginning with the Spanish-American War to this very day.
Right, and that's why, believe it or not, in one of the books that I got, it shows that the reason why the British, when they had the standing army and the Constitution forbids a standing army, mm-hmm. what do we got today? We got a standing army, don't we?
Right, exactly.
Well, why do we have a standing army? You go right back to the Black Pope.
Yep, yep. And, you know, again, I think that this was what was intended, and it was also interesting, perhaps coincidental, though I doubt it, that right at the time we started to emerge as a military power, which was obviously promoted and nurtured, Britain got into a nasty little affair with the Boers down in Africa and decided enough of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what led, obviously, to Rhodes' comment about we have to bring the United States back into tow, which I don't really
right.
think it ever left, to fight the wars that our best blood can no longer.
Mm-hmm. That's like the Spanish-American War. You start from there, and then you go to World War I, then World War II, and then you got all the conflicts, Vietnam and Cambodia, and, you know.
Let's end on this note, if you would, because I talked about this with Phelps a long time ago, and we've never mentioned this, but now where you're at this very moment in time, here's what cracks me up. We get into the Spanish-American lopsided fiasco
uh-huh.
and wind up taking the Philippines and Puerto Rico.
Right.
But we don't touch Cuba.
Uh-huh.
And my point is throughout time, right through what I would call brinksmanship in the October Missile Crisis, to this very day, if there's ever been a nation that should be in what Bush called the axis of evil, I'm thinking that a government that had its missiles pointed at us 90 miles away from where I live might fit that bill, but nobody ever touched Cuba. And to this day, no one has ever touched Cuba.
That's right.
And the fact that it's avoided an invasion by the U.S., I think is highly, highly provocative.
Yeah, like the Bay of Pigs.
Well, yeah, and that's another whole...
That never happened, you know?
Well...
it was supposed to.
There's a whole thing going on with that, too, because something stinks there as to who really wanted that to happen and who really torpedoed it.
Right.
And if, in fact, I believe it's correct that it was Kennedy's idea, not the CIA's, because I think they were telling Kennedy, hey, it's time for paybacks, and we want Cuba.
Yeah, and because... The Black Pope operates the CIA and the FBI in this country.
Well, the thing is, there are some people who say that the mob didn't want Cuba back. They were doing very... Look, Las Vegas is not Cuba, okay?
No.
Las Vegas is all right. It does well out in the West, but Las Vegas is not Cuba.
No.
I got to believe...
Atlantic City is too far away, too.
I mean, come on. Look at it. I mean, ugh.
Yeah.
At any rate, if Kennedy owed the mob for the election being thrown, obviously...
Uh-huh.
It was time for paybacks, and if that was somewhat of an attempt to get Castro out to restore commerce back into Cuba, who torpedoed it but the CIA?
Mm-hmm.
Not the other way around. And I say that because who does the CIA operate under?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's under the Black Pope.
There you go. And so here, and you know what, this was a book that was castigated for being anti-American and mm-hmm. telling too many secrets. There is a book out there called The Invisible Government.
Yeah.
By two authors, and they just took a deep look at the CIA, apparently deeper than a lot of people at that time wanted. And we're talking 1964.
Right.
The reason that was given for the public consumption of what went wrong with the Bay of Pigs,
uh-huh.
and to me, and in the eyes of some military people I've talked to, this is completely impossible. The reason why it didn't work was that they got screwed up with time zones from the air cover coming out of Nicaragua in the central time zone and, of course, coming in the eastern time zone with Cuba. In other words, every military man will tell you probably know this, that you run on Zulu time, which is Grand Meridian time.
Right.
So you don't have that problem. To say that the thing got scuttled because of a time zone problem is like it's a non sequitur.
Uh-huh.
So
because... Do you remember when they had the Cuban Missile Crisis on TV?
I was a
sentient
at that time.
Do you remember the man that was pointing out on the big picture
screen, yeah.
all the missiles and everything?
Yep.
That was my cousin.
Where is he now?
He's dead.
Okay. I mean...
And you should, you know...
No, I know.
I can't tell you what he told me,
okay.
but...
but then it Can we make a presumption here that we're told the CIA wanted to do it and Kennedy got pissed? Is it the other way around?
The CIA, it wasn't because of Kennedy. It was because of the CIA because, you know, the Black Pope controls them.
Yeah, but
the one thing, and what I just got from another book, believe it or not, it shows that the Vatican, the Black Pope, runs FEMA, and it even puts in brackets shadow government.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, well, FEMA is nothing but a controlled
organization like the rest.
Yeah.
But let me just clarify this now. Who wanted to go into Cuba? Who or what?
It wasn't Kennedy.
It wasn't Kennedy.
No.
All right, then my presumption's wrong. But then why would the CIA scuttle itself?
Well, okay.
Unless there were two factions going on at that time in the CIA.
Well, Kennedy, you know, he knew the score. He knew what was going on. And, him personally being an Irish Catholic church person, all right, he was bucking the Black Pope. And it was only because it's kind of convoluted to really explain it, but, you can say that he wanted to go in on Cuba to protect various companies, and that's where he started to butt heads with them, and then he changed back. And one of the things that my cousin did say is he waffled a lot, and we'll let it go at that.
All right.
But anyway, that's when the CIA screwed everything, and they took over when they realized. And then, like Kennedy said, the two things that was fatal to Kennedy, what got him killed by the Jesuits, was one, when the Pope asked him if he was going to go by the Roman canons. I mean, hey, he's an Irish Catholic, yeah. Right?
And he said,
is he going to go by the Roman canons, or was he going to go by the Constitution? And Kennedy said, I'm going to go by the Constitution, and I'm issuing U.S. notes that are debt-free. That's wiped them out.
Sure. And in 59, of course, you know, when he was running for the nomination of the Democratic Party,
yeah,
and he was asked, of all places, in Texas. Now, isn't that rich?
Yeah.
As we can see on YouTube, in Houston, he said that, no, he would not be controlled by the Vatican. Then, you know, I think it was, what, in April 61, and before the New York Press Club, he comes out with that extremely, extremely intriguing paragraph or two in the speech describing a monolithic conspiracy, and he's sure not talking about the Russians, because you would say it was the Russians in that era. He was talking about something that overlaid all countries and availed itself of those countries' resources.
Mm-hmm.
And who would that be, right?
Black Pope.
Yeah.
Vatican.
But I just find it interesting that the reason that was given for the failure of the Bay of Pigs was definitely deliberate sabotage.
Yeah.
And also they stayed at the time, and they were not drawing connecting dots. I am. But at the time that was sabotage, who was in Puerto Rico giving a speech to businessmen but the CIA director, Alan Dulles?
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad listening post if you wanted to see how things were going a couple
that's
of
right.
100 miles to the west.
Yeah.
Oh, I tell you, that's still something.
And he didn't have to get on a boat, did he?
No. Nope. You can't make these things up. Listen, I've kept you for 2 hours, and I really do appreciate it. And I tell you, you've got to be feeling a little bit, because I know I am. But one thing again, folks, you can find a lot of the writings of the informer and also James Montgomery on atgpress.com. That stands for Against the Grain, press.com. That's where you'll find a number of I-Man's books. There is a new one coming out to which we will speak the next time he joins us, hopefully in about a week or so. And again, that title is, as I pull this around, The Constitution for the United States, The Myth and the Reality, Just Who Owns the United States. So perhaps when those books come in some kind of number, sometime next week or the week after, you'll come back on, and we'll address more about this book and some of the things that you've just mentioned cursorily during this particular interview.
Okay.
All right. Would that be okay?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. And I think folks will have a different way of also making it more facilitous for you to order us, but we'll tell you more about that in a week or two's time. Wow. I tell you, we've been through a number of centuries, a whole bunch of continents.
Yeah.
And here we back are again. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. And I guess we're okay with maybe getting together again in a little bit of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that'd be okay. I didn't realize how long it's been because I wasn't watching the clock. It's 1:02 now.
Well, I have to monitor the software that records this, and I'm like, gee, I mean, we're at 158. Well, we're at 159 right now, so that's you did some yeoman's duty there, and I appreciate it, really do, and I know the listeners do as well.
Okay.
All righty.
All right, and so, we'll see you next time. Then.
All right, and we'll be in touch. Thanks a lot, I-Man. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye.
All right, that was the I-Man addressing originally a bit of a postscript to this situation with the Civil War. And, of course, really everything's interconnected, and it's kind of tough to just isolate something. There is nothing isolated in history. So, many of you have made some very favorable comments, some very interesting comments and insights about the Civil War. As one person said, you know, the more you know about it, the weightier the issue gets, and you don't even know if it isn't getting even more and more obscure. With that amount of information comes, you know, some other burdens, if you will. and the reaction that we got from the series was one that I thought we'd get, and that is it worked out the way that I wanted to, in that it still raises questions, but it makes people consider it. And those who thought perhaps that the Civil War was based on slavery and what we're told about in our history books, in fact, it's a shame because the slave somewhat almost got forgotten in that whole situation. What a surprise. So I want to thank you for being with us. This is the last one that we'll do, at least in this amount of time. Maybe we'll do something down the road, but that'll kind of finish us with the Civil War and the way it left the United States. Thanks for being with us, folks, and we will see you shortly.
She kept me with her pink. I was making love all night and playing guitar all day. I got me apple cider and homemade bread to make a man say grace. And clean linens on my bed and a warm feed fireplace. Just a memory. Birds are sound words.